This is Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping. With your hosts, William Whitebread and Mark Audio Slave Stewart.
Hey, motherfuckers, welcome back to another episode of Rock Isn't Dead, It's Just Sleeping, with yours truly, Willie Whitebread.
Mark the Audio Slay.
And I want to welcome back our favorite guest star, Delta Drew Pearson. Welcome back.
What up?
Welcome back. He is a blues aficionado, so he had to be back for this follow-up segment from our last episode about the origination of the blues music in America.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So where did we leave off last episode?
We left off with, I think, the 50s, the mid-50s blues blues segments in America, kind of the Chicago blues scene. The West Coast blues scene. So for those of you that didn't watch last time, we spoke a lot about how the entire basis for rock and roll, obviously you have different jazz chords in there, you've got jazz progressions, you've got classical influences from composers and things of that nature, but the primary contribution to modern rock and roll that you know today came from the blues.
Right.
Absolutely.
And if you know anything about rock and roll music throughout time, even if you don't, you can probably recognize it as we say it. There has always been a slightly esoteric and consistent battle of the musical notes between British and American. Different scenes.
Now we're talking.
You know what I mean?
See, but you got to think about it. A lot of the Americans were sent over to Britain by record companies to do specifically that. They were like, hey, you know, you're a really good blues artist, but you know, we're not going to get you, you know, signed here in America.
You're not American.
You're not that good. So, but we're going to send you over to Britain, and then once you impress those guys over there, we're going to send you back to America. Then you can do your U.S. tour.
I think that's also partially because that America was still stuck in the blues was still fairly new, even though it had been around for a couple decades at this point. It was still fairly new because, you know, you didn't have streaming. You didn't have anything like that. You didn't have giant outdoor festivals like you were seeing in the 60s. It was a lot of word of mouth, right? And I think America was still not unaccepting, but kind of naive to the blues movement and also to progression in rock and rolls. Because if you look at rock and roll in America throughout the decades, everything starts as new wave and everything starts as very unaccepted by critics.
See, the way that I see it is that with the blues back in that time period, America was going through differences with racial.
Correct.
Black and white.
Correct.
And the music industry realized that the blues was that good, and they took it across seas to show how good the music was.
Right.
America wasn't seeing it. People were listening to Elvis Presley, people were still listening to show tunes, you know what I'm saying?
And see, though, this is the thing, though. You didn't have, you're exactly right in that. And another big influence on that and why I think that they were sending these artists to Britain is because the British movement, they recognized something progressive earlier on than America did.
They recognized talent.
Exactly.
They didn't see color.
Exactly. They didn't have those problems.
I'm going to be very prominent about that because that's what it was.
Absolutely. That's what it was.
That sucks.
Yeah. And you didn't have Google to where you could just pull up, like you hear a new band on the radio and you go, oh, who's these people? And you pull them up and you see 1,000 good reviews and they're playing live and all this. You know what I mean? You didn't have that. So it was all basically a word of mouth thing. And if with the racial divide in America, these record companies weren't signing these artists based on that.
Absolutely.
So the noise wasn't getting out. And these four prominent record companies within America were the only voice on music in the entire country.
Absolutely.
So there wasn't any racial divide whatsoever in Britain.
No.
I mean, I can't.
Did they not have it? Did they not have? Because weren't they the ones that started it all that in America? So didn't they have that?
I mean,
themselves?
Yeah, in the 1700s.
So when
he's
did Britain?
A good point.
I'm just asking because I don't know. I wanted to know when did Britain stop the whole, you know, civil war type stuff in their country. You know, did they?
It was much earlier than America. They didn't have. They weren't bringing slaves over, and it wasn't. They didn't have a Delta blues. I'll put it to you that point. Yeah. They didn't have a plantation, a huge plantation ownership like the Delta and the Blues did.
Well, I understand that.
I mean, the Delta South. You know what I'm saying?
But what the Britons did like, they loved the American sound of the blues.
Yeah, correct.
So when they had these B-rated blues artists, even even the A-rated blues artists are going over there, to an extent.
Right.
They're going to the shows.
And it was hard to find.
It's not being ignored by the Britons at all.
No.
Yeah. They're going to see these guys and so like that's influencing right there. That's influencing people that are being born or teenagers like Eric Clapton in that time period to be influenced about starting their own sound in Britain. You know what I'm saying? Like going. So like they're being exposed at a very early age to the
right
Brits, so that the Britain English blues invasion can begin.
Absolutely.
Right. And it was interesting too because the reason it got so big is it was so rare. It was very rare to find these American blues artist records. There was only like three different, I think HMV, EMI, and Decca.
Chess.
Yeah.
And Chess Records.
And Absolutely. Chess Records. So they were the only ones that were distributing these American blues records in the early 50s.
Yeah.
But once they, like you said, it spread like wildfire. Once they were listening to it, they saw something different. They recognized a different form of music that could progress, while in America, that talent was stunted based on color.
I think they felt it, without seeing color. They were feeling the music.
Correct.
Like
without the bias.
Singing. Yeah, exactly.
Without the bias. Absolutely. They were looking at it from across the room unbiasedly.
Playing and hearing that, and they were like, wow. All right, this is right. Music right here. Absolutely.
Right.
Good point, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good stuff. And so after recognizing this, let's say, talent of the American, blues scene, they started coming out with their own version of it, which was a mixture of so quote unquote pseudo American blues, jazz, because jazz was nation or worldwide. Everybody had jazz and everybody had folk. I mean, folk came from Europe. That was all European music. And it was called skiffle.
I love it.
That was called skiffle. That was around and prominent in the early 1950s. And that's where you see your artists like Robert Plant. That's where Robert Plant started. He started playing in skiffle bands, Band of Joy, shit like that.
Poetry.
Yeah, poetry, yeah. Shit like that.
Prose.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, that didn't last long, though. They wanted something more, and you had bands like, the Stones, the Yardbirds, all these guys, Cream.
Later on,
Cream.
Yeah, yeah.
You had these guys isn't that the progression of rock and roll? You can see it through, punk rock, thrash metal, grunge scene, progressive black metal, all these different things. You can see rock musicians always want it harder, faster, and louder.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they want. They want to take it and do something different.
Now, when we're talking about the Rolling Stones, the early Rolling Stones were very, very blues, influenced.
I mean, hell, they got their name from Muddy Waters.
Yeah. But if you take, absolutely. If you take what's his face after the drowning, what's his face, Brian Jones, out of the equation, and insert Mick Jagger and the newer Rolling Stones. Are you really getting to get that blues overtone, or is it Brian Jones who's putting that, he was injecting that blues overtone?
I think they all were, because they met Mick and Keith were friends first. They had bumped into each other at a couple of different.
They were in school together.
That what it was? I thought they had bumped into each other.
They were in a boarding school. They were listening to music in 45s, thinking outside, and listening to these blues musicians on 45s.
Yeah. But that they got from one of the one record stores, probably in the 100-mile radius.
Absolutely.
So
they were out just doing what they were doing, hanging out and listening to this, and that's what they wanted to interpret. And you're absolutely correct, But
I think it might have, because what brought them together is their love for the blues. Because Brian Jones, he was a club musician, a vagabond and a club musician at Alexis Corner's club, and Davies, they was at their club because they owned a skiffle club, one of the only ones in the area, and that's how they met Brian Jones, is because they were sending, Mick and Keith were sending Alexis Corner their tapes, and they were like, and they had a house band that was playing predominantly blues.
If I can interject one time about the skiffle, now Do you know the actual definition of skiffle? Was that like something like an acapella type thing, or was that like was something with music?
No, it was a musical. It was a musical style. It was like I said, it was a.
So kind there of was a guitar and a bass. And
yeah,
a drum.
It was a max up. It was a pseudo blues. It was the transition between American Delta blues, which was almost country in the Britain's eyes. It was a mashup between there, taking a step further, and so it was the in between bridge between the British blues rock and roll pseudo movement in the American blues movement. Skiffle was kind of the bridge into that.
Okay.
Because they took it and they were like, skiffle, this is cool, but it's still a little slow and a little, we want a little bit more crunch to this.
Kind of like the juke joint kind of sound. He's
exactly.
Okay. Music I got you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was kind of a transitional music genre.
I know not a lot of people out here are going to know the skiffle, including myself. I was like, because when you just said that, I was like, what the hell is skiffle? I've never heard of skiffle at all.
It was a weird British transitional period in music in between what you have with the Rolling Stones.
Cool. All right.
So I guess we can talk about the Rolling Stones a little bit. You're a big Stones fan, Drew, right?
Absolutely.
So what do we love about the Stones?
Oh, the sound, the sound that they're trying to get into, the rock and roll, get into with the blues.
Mm-hmm.
It is just, to me, it sounds heavy. It's
yeah.
It's very, you feel it. You know, these guys definitely felt it when they were hearing it. They definitely wanted to emulate it, and they achieved it. And that's what made them big to start off with. They were more blues-driven than rock and roll. They became rock and roll later on in their careers than they
Oh, now are you talking about Brian Jones, or are we talking about Mick Jagger?
I'm talking about
all of them together.
Yeah. That's the sound they were wanting
to emulate. Okay, so Mick Jagger and Brian Jones did perform together.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't know. I don't know anything about that.
That's the beauty of it.
Beauty of it, man. Yeah, Brian Jones, he was an intense musical powerhouse. That guy could play everything with strings on it. He was very
smart about it. He heard blues. He felt it. That's the beauty of the British blues explosion. These guys felt it differently than Americans did.
Did Brian sing?
No, he was a strict musician. He was a strict musician.
Okay, so he was before Keith came in.
No. They were both together.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Jones and Keith were together at one particular time, and because Brian was a superior musician, because he played the sitar, he played the harmonica, he played everything. He wrote Paint It Black. This guy, he was by far the superior musician. So to me, and I'm sure a lot of people disagree. Brian Jones to me was kind of the father figure musically to Mick Jagger and Keith Richards.
I don't know. Keith Richards I'm going to use the word again. He emulated it. He wanted to sound like the blues. And he achieved it.
Right.
And like I said, they got popular with it, and they made their sound their own.
But Brian, he was very eclectic. He was very unpredictable. He was already a vagabond at the time. He was traveling around Europe all the time, getting chicks pregnant, getting in fucking fights. He was not showing up to practice, hooked on every drug on the fucking planet.
Not to linger on the Stones too much, but Brian Jones, how long was he with the Stones for?
Probably, I think it was their first three or four albums. It was their first three or four albums Brian was with them, and then Keith and Mick kicked him out because they were starting to gain momentum.
Then getting into the Sticky Fingers.
Yeah, and getting into Sticky Fingers and doing U.S. tours. And he couldn't even go to the U.S. That's why they booted him, because he got, I think it was two drug charges, and they denied his work visa.
Was it in the U.S.?
No. That was in the U.K.
He was in the U.K.
Yeah, and he had crashed like a car through a window, and he was already pending on probation for one drug charge, and so they denied his work visa to tour the U.S. and that's when Mick and Keith came to him and was like, look dude, you gotta fucking go.
God, I love fucking
music. Then he had a suicide,
his quote-unquote
may or may not be that
his drowning. And then he was replaced by Mick Taylor in 74.
I mean, you got to think about it too. I mean, think about it. The Rolling Stones compared to the Beatles, which were out before them, not too much longer. And the Beatles didn't even sound like the Rolling Stones.
No.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. It's incredible to me. I mean,
the Beatles weren't trying to sound like the Rolling Stones. The Beatles at that time, after they got famous, they were trying to sound like more like the Beach Boys.
But my point being, when I'm saying that is that the Beatles were such an influential band. That's how you had to be, you know. Yes,
but they continued
suits and shit. But the Rolling Stones kind of did that at first with it. Mick Jagger had that feeling of music, and that's what made that band like they are, with Keith Richards playing the blues, basically.
Right.
That's what separated them, and it's just awesome. It's awesome.
Well, it is awesome.
Let me just say real quick before we continue.
Oh.
There is a documentary I just watched on Netflix. It was called Echo in the Canyon. And it's got Jacob Dylan.
Was it about a pirate hooker over there on the Sunset Strip?
It's about Jacob Dylan.
Sorry, I had to fucking say it.
It's about Jacob Dylan spearheading the documentary about how the 60s, you know, but Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Yeah, yeah.
You had the Mamas and the Papas. Mm-hmm. You had the Beatles, who were influenced by the Beach Boys. And at the same time, the Beach Boys
were getting
influenced by the Beatles.
Fuck yeah.
So Sgt. Pepper... That album would never have came about if the Beach Boys hadn't come out with their latest album.
Yeah.
Animal, I forget what
they. Well, they had mixed their sound because that and that's another rabbit hole, but that's exactly right, and that's a great point because.
But no, what I wanted to say was if people haven't seen Echo in the Canyon, and it's about Laurel Canyon in California, which is an awesome place.
Yeah.
Check it out because it's a really cool documentary.
Groovy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point, man. And surf rock, the beginnings of surf rock like that, I think that's not as influential, obviously, as the blues, but that is intensely, like guys like the Beach Boys and Dick Dale and shit like that, they are intensely influential on rock and roll music.
Right. So what I was trying to say was, initially, was that the Beatles went for the 60s type sound.
Right.
You know, versus going into that Rolling Stones blues type sound.
Right.
That's what I was trying to say. So right. That's kind of where they went their separate ways.
Right.
I mean, technically, if you want to, I mean, if we're going to say here, I'd say Revolver, great album with the blues. Oh,
absolutely.
Revolver is fucking great.
Fantastic album.
Love that.
And also, I want to get into at the same time in Britain as the Rolling Stones are budding and forming, there's another group that I think focuses, I mean, if there was ever a beautiful mixture in a bowl of the Beatles transition, sprinkle some blues in, and then start to mix it up a little bit, the fucking Yardbirds.
There we go.
Super group.
Super group. And I feel like when you listen, if you close your eyes and listen to the Yardbirds, it's like you almost can hear like if the Beatles made a blues album.
Yeah.
That's what it would sound like, the Yardbirds.
Yeah.
Love it.
You know what I mean? They're fantastic, and obviously the powerhouse guitar players that walked out of there was probably some of the best in the entire world ever.
And then there was the Animals.
And the Animals. Oh,
of course, House of the Rising Sun, absolutely.
Blues. But after the Yardbirds, because we touched a lot about the Yardbirds last episode.
We did.
Yeah, they were super influential. For those of you guys that didn't listen to last week's episode, there's a lot into the Yardbirds. Yardbirds were another bridge band between the American blues and the budding transition into the British blues movement. And that's, you wouldn't have Led Zeppelin without the Yardbirds. You wouldn't have Jeff Beck without the Yardbirds, and you wouldn't have Eric Clapton without the Yardbirds.
Now let's break that down. We've already broken down a whole episode on Led Zeppelin.
Right.
So when Jimmy Page left the Yardbirds, mm-hmm. he created Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Okay. So when Jeff Beck left the Yardbirds, not until years later, he created ELO, which
right.
is Electric Light Orchestra, for people who don't know.
Yeah. Mark couldn't wait to make that cameo. He loves ELO.
I love it. I love them.
They're a great band.
They're really good.
Great, really good band. And Jeff Beck, anything he does is great.
Why do you love ELO?
Well, I just love that they have that classic sound. It's not completely bluesy, but it still has that big band, you know, like 1950s type sound to it, especially
right.
like Living Thing.
Absolutely.
You know, that song,
yeah.
to me, it just embodies a yeah. lot of the 50s.
It's before the psychedelic, it's before American music industry retorted with psychedelic rock.
Right.
It was still that prime mixture of American blues and British rock and roll.
Most importantly, when we leave the Yardbirds, it's going to be Eric Clapton, because Eric Clapton and the Bass Breakers.
Yeah.
John Mayall.
Blues Breakers. Excuse me.
You're all good. I got you.
Yeah. I got you, man.
So you explain to us how that band became who they are, to the blues.
John Mayall, he was a harpist, dude, and he wanted to make a blues band, and that's what he did. You know, I mean, Derek and the Dominoes, basically, in my opinion, is right there with it. But John Mayall is very influential when it comes to British blues explosion.
So, if anybody doesn't know, Derek and the Dominoes was also an Eric Clapton based band,
absolutely,
before Cream.
Then, yep. if we bring up Derek and the Dominoes, that's where Eric Clapton got his start with singing the song Layla. Mm-hmm. But John
and
Mayall,
that was his first time singing as well.
Yeah, John Mayall used Eric Clapton as a lead guitarist for the blues for that band. Mm-hmm. That's where he got his sound from. John Mayall knew it. He loved it.
And
yeah.
John Mayall said, "Hey, Eric, why don't you start singing a little bit?"
To be honest with you, think about it. John Mayall and the Blues Breakers were one of the only bands, if from that British blues explosion that used a harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
I can't sit here and think of too Which many is, other bands that can you used think of, a harmonica.
No, besides a guitar.
I can think can of an think individual of, person.
But yeah, you know what I'm saying? Besides, yeah. besides a guitar, could you think of an instrument that says the blues more than a fucking harmonica?
No.
I mean, the no. harp, like you're saying, that's you know, the other, you know, white meat for the blues.
Right.
You know
and they started using that a lot more over there in Britain with Cyril Davies, when Cyril Davies and Alexis Korner together, they started using that a lot more because he was a primary harmonica player. He played the harp as well. But that's when you started, yeah, that's when you started really mixing it together. Cause, and that's why, mm-hmm. you know, everybody has their different opinions and they're all true. That's the problem. Like, they're all true when it comes to mixing in the blues like that, or who was the godfather of this and who wasn't, who begot what and what begot this. Corinthians fucking 189, you know what I mean? Soundgarden, Cornell 1620, you know, whatever. but it all started in, you know, from America over there to the skiffle thing, and then, you know, those two guys, Cyril and Alexis, they're opening up this blues club and they're starting to pull these American musicians in. Because remember, you were talking about that, you know, when we were offline, is that's how they started, the American artists started getting bigger, is they were getting pulled to Britain because that's who made the scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then you guys were going to talk about how Jimi Hendrix was kind of involved in that whole situation, yeah, right?
Everybody wants to sit here and think that Jimi Hendrix was started here in the States, and he wasn't.
He was not. He wouldn't get the time of day in the States.
He was over in Britain, mm-hmm. you know, doing time for World War II,
probably.
Something like that. And he was doing time over there. That's where he made his band. A lot of them were over there. So that's what he did.
Yep. Yeah.
Everybody tends to forget about that.
Yep. And there was also a time in Alexis Korner and Cyril's club over there in Britain when Eric Clapton got to play with Jimi Hendrix. I mean, it's hard to say how should I word that? Did Jimi Hendrix get to play with Eric Clapton, or did Clapton get to play with Jimi Hendrix?
You said it first.
No. I think it might be the second way around.
Jimi got to play with Clapton?
Jimmy was special, man. He had that special sauce on his flavor of
burrito,
of
baby. You know you've been good.
So he agrees the first way. You know,
Clapton was lucky to play some stuff with Jimmy. That's how I'm looking at it, man. Because
you're right. You're right.
I think you're right. I think you're right, man. He was one of those shining stars. Jimi Hendrix was one of those shining stars that comes around once every, you know, century.
Yes.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It just and that's what kills a lot of these guys, man. I'm telling you, that's Jimi Hendrix and Joplin and Kurt Cobain.
27 Club.
Yeah, all these guys. Brian Jones. That's what kills these human beings, is they are way too fucking good for their own good.
They didn't know it.
You can't handle it. You're just way too much of a savant.
Pioneers.
Way too much of a pioneer.
Just didn't know it.
And another thing that I've always loved about Eric Clapton, obviously there's many things that I love about Eric Clapton, but he's much like Bob Dylan. I'm not a big Bob Dylan fan, but look at these two guys. You got Eric Clapton, you got Bob Dylan. Every single time, because how many times has Eric Clapton been huge? We'll start there. Derek and the Dominoes, the Blues Breakers, the Yardbirds, Solo, all these things, right?
With just his name.
With just his name. And he does it every decade, and he'll go, everybody's like, yeah, fucking Eric Clapton, fucking Eric Clapton. And he'll go, you guys like what I'm doing, huh? I'm going to change it.
But you know, if you go to an Eric Clapton show, his bread and butter is fucking playing a fucking 35-45 minute blues fucking solo.
Right.
That's his bread and butter.
But that
Eric Clapton is God, right? But nobody knew it until he sang a song, and that's when he exploded. You know, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers.
Right.
He gave them that opportunity.
That's it.
But isn't that hilarious, though? Like, he's just like Bob Dylan in that regard. Like, he's with the Yardbirds. Everybody loves fucking Eric Clapton. He's like, you love it? You love what I'm doing? I'm going to change it, and I'm going to go over here to the Blues Breakers.
See, Bob Dylan was famous for lyrics. Eric Clapton was famous for playing blues licks.
Right.
That's the difference between the two.
Dude, so I'm just going to bring this up, just saying it. What is it? 461 Ocean Boulevard, where he actually sings the Bob Marley track, you know?
Yeah.
Shout the Sheriff.
That's right.
He totally blues that.
Yep. And sounded great.
Nobody ever did that before he did that, you know?
Nobody ever slowed down Layla.
Nope.
I don't think he can.
Interesting.
He did for his acoustic set.
Oh, slow it down for his acoustic set. Talking about slowing it down weirder.
It's just interesting. I mean, the guy he changed a lot of things.
He changed music.
Once somebody gave him a shot to sing.
Right.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even in the Yardbirds long. Nope. He was in the Yardbirds for like 2 years.
What happened to him?
When he just left.
So where did he go? He just went.
He went off and went solo for a little bit.
And nobody listened to him.
After the Yardbirds, he went to John Mayall.
Right. He was solo for a very short time, and then he went to John Mayall and the Blues Breakers.
He stayed with the Blues.
Yeah.
And he played lead guitar.
And then when did he break off and go to Derek?
After that, and then that's when Derek and the Dominoes gave him the opportunity to sing, and then it's the rest is history.
The rest is
history. How many hits did Derek and the Dominoes have?
Not
many.
No, nobody.
One or two, right?
Not many.
If that.
With or without Clapton?
Layla was their hit, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was their number one.
Absolutely. I think they had like maybe four or five albums.
So what made him go from Derek to Cream?
He wanted something different. Yep. That's what, and that was my previous
usually
point.
Usually what happens with a musician, if you can't live with somebody while you're on the road with somebody.
And it might have been that,
but
it's too
early to
tell. You
want to get the fuck away from that person.
Right.
So a lot of 99% of the time, it's not because they're a great musician, but it's because you like them as a friend and you can live with them while you're traveling together.
But it's too early to tell. You know what I mean? That could have been that. It could have been a little bit of creative differences, but it wasn't so prominent as in, you know, Jimmy Page, you know, leaving the Yardbirds.
I mean, if you think about it,
it wasn't just so prominent as if a transition as that.
You want to progress.
Yeah, he wants to do something different.
He wanted to progress,
yeah.
And that's what he was doing.
And that's the Bob Dylan syndrome. He did the same thing. I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to change it, and I'm going to go do this now.
What makes the guys in Derek and the Dominoes different than the guys that he came to perform with in Cream? Were any of those guys in Cream from Derek and the Dominoes besides him?
No.
I think you're deviling too far.
But see,
I don't know. I'm just asking you guys if you know.
With these savants, something could be off. Like with Jimmy Page is a very beautiful example. And so is Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix fired so many musicians. He left so many different groups, and he bounced around until he got what he wanted.
A lot of solo guys do that.
A lot of solo, because they have a sound.
Look at Trent Reznor. If it wasn't Trent Reznor for firing the guys from Filter, Filter would have never came
out. Exactly. They have a sound. They have an image in their head. And if what they're doing in this moment, successful monetarily, be damned, if it's not what they want to do in that particular moment, they're not going to do it. They can't. They can't handle it as a person. That's why they're still alive.
Yeah.
And they aren't.
So, getting there. So, we have these albums that these guys made, including Eric Clapton. So, what about, bringing it up different. What about Led Zeppelin? What do you think their best blues album was when they were formed?
Oh, Led Zeppelin 2.
Led Zeppelin 2 is a fantastic 100%. Blues rock and roll
It has
explosion.
To be, because after Led 100%. Zeppelin 2, it just got super fast and fast and fast and fast.
Yeah.
Like they were just trying to push all the way to the end of Led Zeppelin.
Then you had Led Zeppelin 3, you know, that album was definitely bluesy as well. Then you get into Led Zeppelin 4 and then Physical Graffiti, where they started getting more rock and roll, but they were still early days. They were still blues.
But if you listen to them from beginning to end, they're going from slow to fast. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what people wanted.
Houses of the Holy is a really bitching album, dude.
Fucking my favorite. You know, but see, Led Zeppelin 2, I feel like that's a super prominent example of their blues roots because it literally has a stolen fucking song on it.
Absolutely.
Whole Lot of Love.
Well, there's
a fucking Willie Dixon song.
There's a couple of their songs that supposedly were stolen.
Well, they
Juice
are,
runs right? down the leg, man.
That's it.
We were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
Willie Dixon sued them in the 80s because of, you know, everybody started seeing I don't know if I'm saying is right. Music infringement. Like they were stealing it.
Yeah. That's the first of its kind.
Well,
but that's when it started coming about.
And we also said this too, that it doesn't matter if whoever picks up a six string and plays a rock and roll chord right now is stolen it from somebody.
We were just talking about
it. You know what I mean? That's right. You're always and what Led Zeppelin, I can't call it stealing. They borrowed it for a second, put it in the dryer, and it came out something different because the basis of the song was written, but what Led Zeppelin did to that song was ground shaking.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Yes, did they borrow the basis of the song and the lyric progression from Willie Dixon? Sure.
Puts a smile
on
my face.
Isn't that the point? If you take a song from another artist, you want to make it yours. You want to make it better. You don't want to make it sound like the original.
And you're right. And you want to, you want to still incorporate that sound and say, hey, this is what I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah. You want to give them kudos when you're talking to like the press and stuff about it.
But you know, Led Zeppelin, when they started their transition, and I think when all the bands started their transitions, it's same like Cream and Fleetwood and Zeppelin and all these guys. We'll get to Fleetwood in a minute. But you can see the transition from hyped up rock and roll, and even in the Stones, look at their transition from the 60s to the early 70s. The early 70s is what broke the blues, like the very traditional blues roots. There was still I shouldn't say the blues roots. They sped it up. and changed it and put some distortion on it and made it something different.
They electrified it.
That's right. They electrified. Great word.
My favorite song by the Stones is Can You Hear Me Knocking? It's like a 12-minute song, but it's still bluesy. They get down in there jamming out, dude. And they still break it down to that 12-bar blues.
Yeah.
Amazing. And nobody else had a 12-minute song like that when the Rolling Stones did Can You Hear Me Knocking on Sticky Fingers.
Right.
It was amazing. I think there was, two or three tracks on side A on that album on the vinyl?
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, just think about that.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And so, like we said, the blues is the bassist for all rock and roll.
So there was a point in the British blues invasion where it kind of the well kind of dried up.
And that's what I mean. I think it was the late 60s.
And so
I think when the late 60s
happened was is that all these bands were coming in from Britain and they were all throwing like crazy blues, like, you know, traditional blues licks and all kinds of, you know, influenced blues, improv and stuff. And then it kind of just dried up.
Mm-hmm.
But then America kind of just stepped back and said, hey, we still have it.
Hey, so that's cool, guys.
We originated the blues. So we're going to come back and we're going to, you know, keep coming with it. You know what I'm saying? So like we kind of embraced it from Britain and kind of said, okay, you know, Eric Clapton, keep fucking playing for us because we fucking like you. You know what I'm saying? Like he never fucking died. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's just keeping up with the Joneses is what it boils down to. And it's that fucking thing that America and Britain have done all throughout time with music. It's okay. The British started something. Cause where did music go from the British blues explosion? Where did it go? It went to the American psychedelic rock explosion of the mid to late 60s. It's always a back and forth. Right. Then it went to the British punk scene. Started forming in the mid 70s and then back to the US with the thrash metal scene. It was just, it's a constant.
But then if you flash forward to the 80s and the 90s, and then you have fucking, you know, Vi and fucking Vaughn and fucking, Bonamassa even to today, you know.
Bonamassa. Like, I mean, Joe Bonamassa.
He's not getting credit where his credit's due because he's still fucking out there touring. You know what I'm saying? He's still trying to prove himself, even though he's been proving himself since he was 12 or fucking years old.
Right. So with back to that, we're going off in rabbit holes, which I love. I love it. It's so easy to do with blues because it's such a broad spectrum. It's like the Force. Blues is like the Force. It's all around you. It's in everything you know.
It is. I
want to say this real quick. There are two people.
Don't say it quickly. Elongated.
A lot of people forget that you can obviously say the big name, which is Jeff Beck. A lot of people forget about Jeff Beck.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here thinking about Eric Clapton. All right.
Yeah.
There were these albums that were made by Chess Records, right? Where there were musicians, they handpicked them. And Eric Clapton, like Howlin' Wolf, and they did an album with Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of them. There were like, I'm wanting to say four or five. But I always forget to bring up this man's name, and his name is Steve Winwood. He was a pianist dude that played a lot and was always with a lot of these bands that played the piano. I'm looking at it right now.
Bring me to higher love.
He is a great musician.
Everybody knows he's a favorite.
Everybody forget. I just thought about it right now. Exactly. A lot of people forget about that, man. And he is a really good pianist. Goes with the blues. Steve Winwood was a great musician.
Right.
I'm just bringing it up.
You're right.
Oh, yeah. You're totally right. You're totally right.
I mean, he was famous in the 80s for his solo stuff.
Right.
For a couple, one album.
Musician.
But before that, he was totally a blues guy.
Yeah. The piano. Now, don't get me mistaken. Don't think that jazz doesn't play with the blues at all, because that's another good point about the blues is in the mid 40s, it shifted from that Delta blues sound, you know, putting chicken wire up on nails on the side of a house and playing at juke joints. It shifted to the Chicago blues scene, which was very heavily piano oriented.
Yes.
Oh, it was
big because band. They were playing in front of big band.
It was big band.
Because they were playing
fucking bassy with the blues. Basically.
Yeah. Because they finally had a following and they started, they're like, well, we can't fit a fucking grand piano in this shed that everybody's drinking in. So they're starting to play in front of big audiences. So they need big band, big sound.
Love it.
So piano is a very huge influence in blues music, and that's a great point. Fantastic point.
So I just had to bring that up for a second. You know?
Absolutely.
But he's always been there. And had to say it. So
yeah.
I don't think
we're done with Clapton yet. We haven't talked much about Cream. We've broached the subject that he was in Cream.
Blind Faith.
Yeah.
I think
Blind Faith. Right.
Blind Faith.
great album. Definitely an album cover that was that'll never be forgotten.
No,
especially when it was released.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of them dabbled with that shit too, like weird, crazy album art. That's what I miss about albums, and that's one of the things I appreciate about Tool. Because they keep that. Because back
in the
60s,
is that what you appreciate about Tool?
That's what I appreciate about Tool.
I see.
So I do want to talk about
Tool's
Cream.
Another day, buddy.
That's another day, another dog, another fight, an entirely different ring. But I do want to talk about Cream a little bit. So we talked about the ever so evasive Eric Clapton. No band can lock this man down. But he was with Cream for a little while. He was with Cream for I think 4 years. They released four studio albums.
Now, if you guys listen to Cream.
Yeah.
Besides their, you know, what is it? The two hits that they had. They had
Strange Brew and.
Well, no, they had Strange Brew. Okay, three. So they had Strange Brew. They had White Room. And
yeah.
Then they had
White Room.
There was another. There was one more.
Sitting on Top of the World. That was a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good song.
No, Sunshine of Your Love.
Sunshine of Your Love.
That
right.
was the other one I was thinking of.
Well,
so now if you take those three songs, basically,
yeah,
and then if you listen to all their B sides. Is it going to be all blues? Because I'm not familiar with
that. A lot of their songs are because they bounce around because this, and this is why I bring up Cream and why they're so, to me, they're so influential. Because you remember before, we spoke about the bridge between the 60s and the 70s, right? Being the bridge being the transition right. from blues-oriented rock and roll to the American psychedelic rock and roll.
Now, to me, what the 60s to the 70s brings, okay, so like there's two sides to that. There is people playing Les Paul, Gibson Les Paul guitars, and then there's people playing the Rickenbacker guitars.
Right.
Okay, so the Rickenbacker guitars, if people don't know, has a little bit of a hollow body.
Right.
It sounds like more like the Mamas and the Papas.
Right.
We talked about the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
That type of guitar sound.
Right.
Versus heavier, bluesier, rock and roll
right.
stuff.
Exactly.
Where that's where Cream kind of came in.
Right. And that's one of the big reasons why Eric Clapton quit. Because him and Jack, or Ginger, not Jack Bruce, but him and Ginger Baker got together and were like, this is too fucking loud. So this was their transitional period. This is a little bit of a segue. Call this Eric Clapton musical puberty.
Okay.
Is what Cream was. Okay, he took a couple years and did something weird because they put out four studio albums from 1966 to 1969, right?
Absolutely.
And this was the bridge between the blues-oriented rock and roll into the psychedelic thing was the late 60s, early 70s. Because Fresh Cream came out in 66, and then their final fourth studio album, Goodbye, came out in 69. In between that, you had Disraeli Gears and Wheels of Fire. You know,
and Irish Cream.
Okay. Irish Cream. Yeah, the Bailey's album, the Bailey's right. edition with Triple Green. So like if you listen to Sunshine of Your Love or Strange Brew, those are very much psychedelic rock and roll songs.
Influence, right.
Very much Booker hard
T,
rock.
Booker T.
Right. And so essentially at the end when they were writing Goodbye, they were touring nonstop, Cream was. Non-fucking stop.
They played Woodstock, didn't they?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think Cream played Woodstock.
So
No.
Clapton was not a Woodstock.
I don't believe Clapton. I think they played... I think you're thinking of the Isle of Wight Festival.
Maybe.
In England.
Yeah.
They played that.
It's still going on today, by the
yeah.
way.
Yeah. So when they were writing the Goodbye album, obviously that's, you know...
Yeah.
Satirical of what's going to happen. So Ginger Baker and Eric Clapton got together, and once again, the ever so evasive Clapton goes, this is not what I want to do. I want to go back to the basics. I want to go back to my roots, which is why he left Cream. Ginger Baker went off the fucking deep end and moved to Africa and like rode giraffes and shit. You know, RIP, Ginger Baker just died recently. And so that is when Eric Clapton, like I said, it's his kind of his musical puberty years. He took a second to go do a little bit of something different, realized he didn't like it, and he came back to the blues. The blues pulled him right back in.
So that, is right that when he went to his solo?
That's right. Okay. That's when he went full solo.
Then he had Crossroads and Cocaine.
That's right.
After Midnight.
That's right.
You know.
That's when the birth of Slowhand came.
Ocean Boulevard.
That's it. The birth of Slowhand Clapton. That's it.
Yep. And whoa, hey. Do you guys remember where Slowhand, the nickname, came from?
I don't. Tell me.
Enlighten me.
So, when Eric Clapton was playing by himself in a band before the
In the bathroom?
Before
when he was playing
before
by himself?
The Yardbirds. He was playing in England, right? Before he was known that well. So he would break a string on stage constantly every time he played live. So he would, instead of saying like, you know, okay guys, give me 1 second, we're going to take a hiatus. He would stay on stage, take the string and do that right in front of everybody and put a string back on the guitar. And so when that was happening, all the British people would be like, and it would be a slow clap. So therefore, that's why he gained the nickname Slow Hand.
Real quick, don't British people always clap at the same time over there? Like, you know, us over here, we're like, ah, clap, clap, clap. British people, don't they like clap all at the same time?
I don't know, man.
I don't know.
They do funky stuff.
But they were doing that while he was changing his string on his guitar, and that's where he got the nickname.
Fair enough.
Fair enough. Maybe they clap like this. I don't know how British people clap.
Thank you for that.
But thank you for that enlightening piece of history. Yeah. I do like that because I love Eric Clapton. I do. I just love him. He's just so great.
I don't blame you.
So let's talk about another influential blues band, and I know you know who this is. Fleetwood Mac.
Hell yeah.
Fleetwood Mac. A lot of people believe that Fleetwood Mac is Stevie Nicks. It's all the Stevie Nicks years. That's actually the very latter half of Fleetwood Mac.
She came later.
Yeah, she came much later. Much, much later. So let's talk about Fleetwood. That's one of your favorite bands, Drew.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about Fleetwood.
Do you guys know how the members' names? Because I'm a little...
Well, you obviously have the drummer. All right?
Yep.
Mick Fleetwood.
Mick Fleetwood.
Yep. Peter Green.
Peter Green, guitar player.
And then they're...
Are you talking there? They've changed lineup. Dude, it's... You cannot...
Multiple.
I can't...
Okay, so give me the guitar player, guys.
Peter Green.
Peter Green.
And give me another one.
I can't.
Mick Fleetwood. The drummer.
And another one.
There was a second guitarist, Jeremy Spencer, and bassist, John McVie. And
I'm talking about the guy.
Is this who you're talking about?
I'm talking about the guy who created the soundtrack for the National Lampoon's Vacation. He came up with the Holiday Road song.
Are you talking about the young kid, like Danny Kerwin?
No.
No.
Holiday
Danny Kerwin
Road
was the third guitarist.
Holiday Road was created by one of the members, the founding members of Fleetwood Mac. I just can't think of his name.
I have no idea. You've stumped the chump on that one.
No, I've got Google right here in front of you. Let's do it. Right
Google
now.
It.
Let's get shit up.
Because now I'm
what am
beautifully
I
intrigued.
Up? Holiday Road?
Holiday Road.
Are you doing this because of the time of the
Lindsay,
year?
Lindsay Wagner? Is that his name?
Buckingham?
Lindsay Buckingham?
Lindsay Buck. That's exactly it.
He's not a founding member. He came way
he
later.
Holiday
that was
Road,
okay.
So,
all yeah. right. But he wrote Holiday Road. Now, yeah. Not a lot of people know that. That's
yeah.
A little tidbit of information.
Yeah.
On Fleetwood
Lindsay
Mac.
Buckingham was a combo deal with Stevie.
Stevie.
Yeah. They were
like
a thing.
Yeah.
What was that meme I always read? It's like, you know, Stevie Nicks was like the baddest bitch in rock history because she broke up with her man, then made him play guitar for her for 2 years. She left her man, her boyfriend for another man and made him play guitar
you
for her for 2 years. Yeah. So great. So Fleetwood has an amazing history. And probably one of the more, I didn't realize how eclectic these guys and gals' history was until I started getting into them.
To me, they were influential on many aspects. Everybody knows the name Fleetwood Mac, dude.
Right.
And nobody knows what they were before.
Yeah.
The pop, they were before they were pop.
Yeah.
Right? They were an influential blues band, and nobody understands that nor even thinks about it.
Yeah,
Peter Green was just amazing with Mick Fleetwood doing it. They were just blues.
Now
all
something
the way.
Something interesting that you may not know, you probably know Drew. I don't know if you know Mark, but where did Peter Green come from before he started Fleetwood Mac?
Ooh, come on,
John Mayall and the
John
Blues
Mayall
Breakers.
And the Blues Breakers.
Yeah. Peter Green replaced Eric Clapton when Eric Clapton left.
Mm-hmm.
And so Peter Green broke off from John
Mayall
and the Blues Breakers to form Fleetwood Mac with Mick Fleetwood.
And they kicked Peter Green out because was just getting crazy. Like,
yeah. So they had a bunch of crazy shit go on. They picked up the young 18-year-old guitar player, Danny Kerwin, in 1968. He was the third. He was the third guitar player. And so at this time they start writing their first album, which was their self-titled album, which was released by Blue Horizon in February of 68. That was a fucking, if you ever want to hear some real, really good British blues rock and roll, go listen to Fleetwood Mac's original self-titled album from 68.
I'm going to listen to that tonight. That's
actually
my pick tonight.
Yeah.
Another great record label is Polydor, which I do believe that they're on, and their second album, which was their best of. This is off Polydor.
Yeah.
Great, great, great record label.
Yeah, and they were, the thing is they were huge in the UK. Fleetwood got big in the UK because their self-titled album went number 4 on the UK charts. And along those same lines in 68, which is something that some people probably don't know, is what you talked about before the show, is they wrote Black Magic Woman.
You can't deny it.
Santana didn't write that.
Nope.
That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
Fantastic.
Yeah. Everybody, Santana does that, man. He does that. He takes a lot of people's songs and reworks them and stuff.
The man
but
can
it's
play
good.
Guitar.
The man can play guitar.
He can play guitar.
I love his spin-off on things.
Absolutely.
You know, like he's just a who else does that a lot? He just there's always a cameo of Santana. I'll be listening to like a weird album and I see a song featuring Santana. I'm like, what the fuck? He's Carlos, you're everywhere, dude.
He's got to be at least the top 25 guitar players of all time.
Oh, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I can agree.
Carlos Santana, man, he is fucking amazing.
Out of curiosity, Stevie Nicks didn't show up until the Muscle Shoals recordings. Is that right?
No.
I don't think so.
No.
You guys know what I'm talking about.
Sound
Muscle
City.
Sound City.
Muscle Shoals actually getting back to the Rolling Stones.
But no, the
Brown
she
Sugar
was,
Woman was
she was in there,
though.
The Fleetwood Mac was in Muscle Shoals as well.
Maybe they wrote.
Yes, they were.
There.
Have you seen both documentaries?
Yes.
Yes. So I'm right, right?
I'm telling you right now, Stevie Nicks wasn't introduced till at least Sound City.
Yeah. Stevie was introduced in Sound City.
Absolutely.
Wow, but I think she's okay.
Yeah. Lindsey Buckingham has. Well, how the story goes is Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie were recording at Sound City. And Mick Fleetwood was there, and he was listening to them record, and he was like, dude, that's fucking great.
Okay.
Hey, will you guys want to fucking do it? You know
By
what I mean?
By the way, if you've never seen Sound City documentary, watch it.
It's fantastic. That's where a lot of big bands started.
As well as Muscle Shoals.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
a great documentary as well.
Dave Grohl actually has all of the original music equipment,
the soundboard. Yeah.
The soundboard from Sound City, because that's where Nirvana started.
That's correct.
And that's where Soundgarden started, and that's where...
A lot of bands started.
Rage Machine started there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Fleetwood, they also, Chess Records, that's where they were with, and they started including some songs with different menagerie of blues artists. Like they did some Willie Dixon stuff, Buddy Guy. They did some stuff with Buddy Guy, Otis Spann. They did a lot of stuff with them. And then they started doing a lot of touring, and they finally made it over to the U.S. in the very early 70s.
Absolutely.
Late 60s, early 70s is when they finally, it was January 69 is when they started playing in the U.S. And very shortly after that, like Drew was saying, Peter Green in 1970, he had a really bad dependency on LSD. And so he,
how could you have a dependency on that though?
I don't know, man. Like there's a lot of shit out there. I don't think it's a chemical addiction. I think it's one of those things you're addicted to the rabbit hole. You're addicted to a different reality.
Like he lives in that area for his music, and so like he can't produce his music without being on.
Right. How I simplify it for myself is a very ignorant and simplified version, which is. Every morning I start my day off with a cup of coffee. I couldn't imagine. I go to bed. I'm so stoked to get up in the morning to have that first cup of coffee. I couldn't imagine not waking up and spending my day without that first cup of coffee. And I think that's kind of essentially what happened to Peter Green. He became not chemically dependent.
That would drive me fucking absolutely insane.
Yeah, not chemically dependent on LSD, but he was addicted to his routine and the world he lived in on LSD
to get to his music plateaus.
Yep, and you can see that with Jim Morrison as well.
Just to say this, Green was a major figure in the second great epic British blues movement. B.B. King commented, "He was the sweetest tone. He has the sweetest tone I've ever heard."
Yeah,
Eric Clapton praised his guitar playing. 58 out of the top 100 guitar players of all time.
Peter Green, yeah, he's fantastic. Yeah.
People don't know that about Fleetwood Mac. Interesting. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And Jeremy Spencer, the other guitar player, let's talk about another fucking weird thing that happened. So Peter Green's gone now. He was addicted to LSD. Not addicted, but he didn't want to play music anymore. He wanted to do LSD. You know, so in February of 71, guitarist Jeremy Spencer said he was going out to get a magazine and went out and joined the Children of God cult and never was seen again. Never returned to the band. He just fucking left.
It was the 60s we're talking about, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So 60s, very early 70s.
Nobody knew who Jim Jones was and the Kool-Aid down, you know. So nobody knew who these cult leaders were. So they were popping up. You know, Charlie Manson was popping up. Jim Jones was popping up. So I'm sure there was, like, you know, other knockoffs. Like, this guy joined that group. So, I mean... You can't fault him for joining, but at the same time, it's like really, you fell for that.
Yeah, exactly. And so we'll move forward a little bit. There was a lot of back and forth with Fleetwood, and and as it pertains to the British blues movement, they started altering their sound much like everybody did in the late 60s. They still used the blues as the basis of their writing process, but they started adapting the more psychedelic rock and roll sound as was progressive of the time.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Because there wasn't a lot of people that stuck to their guns, i.e. Eric Clapton. You know, at that time period, there wasn't a lot of people back then that were like, this is what I play, and this is all I'm going to fucking play, and I'm going to leave the last three powerhouse groups I was in because I don't want to play that shit.
He was just a record in rotation.
Yeah, and he liked what he liked, and he wasn't fucking sacrificing himself for anybody. Yeah. Kind of like Paul McCartney. He fucking did what he wanted to do, and Steven Tyler, he does what he wants to do, and I'm not doing fucking shit. Trent Reznor, they all do it.
Solo Clapton didn't kind of like transpire really until like the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. And that's when he started getting, you know, I mean, he was always big in the right circles.
He was.
But he wasn't, a, you know,
he
like
wasn't getting nationally like fame.
You weren't seeing Clapton on MTV or anything.
Exactly.
You know, but exactly. So what you're talking about.
Wonderful Tonight.
And what a lot of people want to hear is the story and how Fleetwood became the rumors Fleetwood Mac that everybody knows and loves. So like we talked about in mid-75, Fleetwood was in L.A. checking out Sound City Studios, and the sound engineer was recording Buckingham Nicks.
Yep.
They were recording them, and Fleetwood heard them, and he went up to Lindsey Buckingham and was like, hey, man, you got it. Because at this time, they're going through personnel changes, like fucking costume changes at a play. You know, and they're like, okay. And Lindsey's like, well, I will, but my girlfriend has to come with me.
Oh shit!
Are we
starting to talk about the American blues explosion?
The American blues explosion a little bit.
Kind of reverses itself.
It kind of reverses itself because then America's like, oh man, look what's going on over there in Britain. This is cool now.
Shit.
We're going to take all these artists that were originally flying to Britain to get big.
10 to 15, 20 years later, here we go.
Coming right back.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Stevie and Lindsey Buckingham are now in Fleetwood Mac. Christine McVie, former Christine Perfect, which was John McVie's wife. Now they end up breaking up.
Well, Christine McVie also married Paul McCartney later on.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this was the start of the Fleetwood Mac that everybody knows and loves. And it's funny to me that the band, this is one of the only bands that I know that has two self-titled albums. Fleetwood Mac has a self-titled album in 1968 with the original lineup, and then Fleetwood
Against the Machine.
The Reborn. What was that? Was there Rage Against the Machine? Did they have two self-titled albums?
No, just one.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I'm just being stupid.
Oh, okay. So, and then 75, when Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks came to the band, they had another self-titled album.
Fucking awesome.
Isn't that awesome?
Crazy.
Fucking awesome.
Two self-titled albums.
Almost 10 years apart. 10 years apart, almost.
Sons of bitches.
Awesome. Fucking crazy. And this is, you know, there was, I think, 6 or 7 other studio albums following Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie. But, you know, everybody, you know the story. Stevie Nicks ends up breaking off. But so Fleetwood, the second self-titled album of Fleetwood Mac in 75.
Back up. Stevie Nicks breaks off.
Yeah.
To go solo.
Yes.
And then what happens to Fleetwood?
They continue doing their thing, man. Being the adaptable band that they are.
But nobody listens to them anymore because everybody's going to Stevie's solo shit.
That's right.
Other than what? The Beatles, the Rolling Stones. They're one of the continuously going rock and roll bands.
That's right. And so when somebody says, hey, man, do you like Fleetwood Mac? They're going to go, the normal human being is going to go, of course I do. That album Rumors was amazing.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It's the 1975 to 1977 Fleetwood Mac that everybody knows.
Yep.
But nobody knows that they were a prominent figure in the British blues movement.
There's a song on their second album, Mr. Wonderful, which is a compilation. It's called They Call Me Dr. Brown. If you ever want to listen to that song.
Mr. Wonderful from WWF.
Stop.
No, it's not WWF anymore, bro.
Right?
Yeah. No, what? That was a great, that was a beautiful album, though.
Absolutely.
That was a very prominent example of British blues explosion as well.
I'd have to say it didn't showcase their best material, which their first album definitely did. It definitely gave it a best of, which the other songs were released before that. They were live. So Mr. Wonderful is... You know, it's a compilation.
And that's a good Peter Green album. I mean, the side two to Mr. Wonderful, you've got Even in Boogie and Lazy Poker Blues. I mean, that's...
And I'm actually going to sit here and say I'm pretty sure that Lindsey Buckingham got with Peter Green again and did another album with him not too long ago.
I don't know how long ago it was, but they did.
It wasn't too long ago.
Yeah, because Peter Green kind of woke up a few years after leaving Fleetwood or getting kicked out of Fleetwood, and he started making music again.
Yep.
You know, so it was... Anyway, so that is a... I know it doesn't seem brief as it is an hour, but that is a semi-brief explanation of how the American Delta blues and Chicago blues scenes transitioned into the British blues movement, which would blossom into psychedelic rock and roll and classic rock and roll as you know it. It all ties together like Legos.
Everything is this gonna symmetrical.
Be a whole new topic?
It's going to be a whole new topic, and we're going to feel that topic out after we shut down. But anyway, if you guys ever want to check out the show live, go ahead and go over to our Facebook page. That's Rock Isn't Dead. It's Just Sleeping Facebook page. We do every episode live there. If you have any show ideas, please reach out to me at willywhitebread69@gmail.com.
We're going
to
give away another T-shirt around here.
And we're going to give away another T-shirt very soon. So be on the lookout for that. I want to thank Delta Drew for coming back out.
Thank you all for
and I hope
me.
To have him Thanks, for Delta. Many more Let's many more it. Episodes. We're going to change his name when we go to something else.
Cool with that.
Yeah, go over to Psychedelic Rock. We'll call you something crazy then.
I've been called worse things.
like Dinged Out Drew or something. I don't know.
Drippy Drew.
Drippy Drew or something. We'll figure it out. But anyway, that's it for this week, guys. We love you, and we will be back.
Bye, guys.